You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Before I dive into this week's show, I just want to send my best wishes to a couple of regular listeners who've been a little under the weather recently. So to David and Susanna over in the States, and a little closer to home with the Hampshire family, I'm glad to hear that everything seems to be settling down for you all, and you can all begin to look forward to an unusual Christmas, for at least you're at home. So this week, it is the long overdue return of one of my favourite authors and a very popular guest, David Weatherly. David joins me to discuss his recently released Monsters at the Crossroads, which covers the cryptids and legends from Indiana and is the fourth book in his statewide series. We discuss some of the cases featured in the book, including the strange oil squids of Anderson, Oscar, the Beast of Busco, which is a wonderful, chaotic, cryptid comedy of errors, and somebody really needs to make a film of that. Numerous Bigfoot sightings, stories of giant snakes, runaway gorillas, and much, much more. As always, it's a big thank you for David for joining me, and it certainly won't be a year until David returns to the show. As always, you can sign up to support the show via our Patreon for bonus episodes, early release of the regular show, and all for just $4 a month. Also, next month, an exclusive Patreon-only series will start in January. So if you don't want to miss out, make sure you click the link in the show notes as always. You can also find us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Artwork for the show, as always, by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Okay. Before we join David, I'd like to wish you a very Merry Christmas in this most unusual of years. Wherever you're doing and wherever you are, I hope you have a safe and pleasant one with those you love. Take care, enjoy the show. Merry Christmas. This week, I am delighted to welcome the ever popular David Weatherly back to the show. With two more of the fantastic cryptid and legends of the States released this year, covering both Alaska and Indiana, it is always a delight to spend some time in conversation with David. Welcome back, sir.
Paul, it's always great to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. And how does life find you at this moment, sir?
Excellent. Enjoying it as always.
As always, as one of the busiest men in the world of cryptozoology, David, no doubt you're knee-deep in your next endeavors.
I absolutely am, yeah, working on the next projects, plural, for the coming year. So,
excellent. As always, I anticipate those greatly. So, your most recent book, Monsters at the Crossroads, is the fourth volume in your marvellous collection of legends and folklore and tales from certain states around the US. You've got a fabulous artwork, as always, by Sam Sheeran. And this one has a foreword by a friend of the show, Chad Lewis. Thanks to you. So, what I'm often interested in, David, is how do you decide which state to go after when you're building your project? I mean, because obviously there are certain states where you think, well, Florida, California. And yet, I think one of the things that elevates your books is, out of the four so far, three of them wouldn't be states I would consider as particularly mysterious. If that, without sounding disrespectful.
Oh, sure. Sure. That's actually how it started, in a sense, because, you know, the first one was Nevada and the Silver State Monsters. And when I put that book together, I did it because I was looking at various material I had, and I was very intrigued with Lovelock Cave, which I've been to. It's a whole Sasquatch legend connected to Lovelock Cave. And I started thinking about, you know, there's a fair amount of material here. Now, no one really thinks about monsters in Nevada. You know, Nevada, usually they think, okay, aliens, you know, Area 51. Yeah. And you certainly don't think of Sasquatch typically in Nevada because it's a desert, you know, most people think, no, no way. But, you know, when I started digging through my files, I mean, I've done this so many years and I've amassed so much in terms of material and interviews and eyewitness accounts and everything else. And I started thinking, there's a fair amount here. I'm going to do this. I can do a whole book on monsters in Nevada, which is what happened. And I sort of rolled right out of that one into Arizona because, I had researched a lot in Arizona, various areas. And so did the two. And people responded so well to those books. And, you know, when I sort of started thinking about it, I thought, you know, I've got so much material, I could do one of these on every state. And, of course, that's the most common question probably about this series. You know, are you going to do all 50? Be patient.
Yes.
It's not like I can sit down and write one a day. But, I don't know. It just kind of organically happened because after the first two states, I had spent a bit of time in Alaska. And, of course, it's a very fascinating place. And I just decided to do that one next. And when I started looking at candidates for the next one, I actually had several in mind I wanted to approach. But just with some of the stories that popped out about Indiana to do the next one is, you know, it's kind of what happened and it just flowed very easily. And it kind of happens like that. I mean, I have most states I've done a fair amount of research. You know, there's plenty of material out there, and I kind of like the idea of intermixing some of these states that, as you stated, most people wouldn't necessarily think of monsters. And, you know, Indiana is kind of one of those places. It's right in the middle of the country, and it's so rich in lore of all these various creatures. And truthfully, you know, I had been very intrigued by a story I called The Oil Pit Squids.
Yes.
Which is just such a weird tale. And, you know, I said, I've got to write about this one because so few people knew about it. And it's funny because, you know, you mentioned Chad. Now, Chad lives in the Midwest and, you know, he's a good friend, an outstanding researcher that spends a lot of time in the field like I do. And, you know, I was chatting with him and he had never heard about the oil pit squids. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and it was funny because he was like, I thought I knew every Indiana monster, but I don't know this one. So yeah, it just kind of keeps evolving like that. And if I'm honest, I already know the next several that will be coming out. So.
Excellent. Well, I'll be looking forward to them wherever you decide to take me as a reader, David, because like I say, it is fascinating, especially for people who don't live in the States, to be able to be taken on these journeys around these weird and wonderful legends and stories and experiences that have occurred in these places that, without you shining a light on them, would probably disappear from view. You know, as you say, the oil pit squids, I don't think we can move on without discussing that one. is a very, very peculiar case, primarily because it's quite a modern story, because I think sometimes when you hear these tales that they're 150 years ago or something like that, and we don't really have the lens of being able to sort of investigate modern newspaper reports or maybe even TV coverage of these things. But so the oil pit squids, when I read it, reminded me a lot of a Quatermass film where a strange creature decides to start growing in a nuclear reactor, David. And right. So when I'm reading this, it's got all that kind of fear of modern science and technology and corporate cover-ups and disappearing evidence. So how did you find out about the oil pit squids? Because like I say, if somebody like Chad's unaware of it, this story's too good to keep under your hat.
Just through research, you know, I mean, I really dig in, especially when I go to the various states and, you know, I talk to people and, you know, my investigative style is very old school. And of course, I utilize the internet and modern research materials, but I'm also, you know, fortunate to have a pretty expansive library that I pull a lot of this stuff from. And of course, you know, as I said, the big thing is talking to people, you know, talking to locals and, you know, hearing these stories. And sometimes it's just a hint of something, you know, and someone had mentioned to me, someone in Indiana had mentioned to me about some weird creature in that had been found in an oil pit. And I thought, what in the heck are you talking about? And I started doing some digging and, of course, found some newspaper resources and eventually found, you know, lots of details for the story. And it very much could have easily been an X-Files episode.
Yes.
Because of all the strange things that occurred. So to get to this story, this occurred now in 1997. So as you noted, Paul, this is not this is not something we're digging into from the 1800s or in the 1930s or something. This is, you know, fairly recent history. And it involves a GMC plant in the small town of Anderson, Indiana. Now, this is it's sort of a mid-sized city. It's in the central part of the state. And bear in mind that a lot of Indiana was very reliant on the automotive industry, you know, back in the day. So for a long time, there were automotive plants doing various things in that region. And Anderson had a GMC plant called Delphi that is plant number 9. And this factory, you know, because of what they were making, it was a interior and lighting plant, and they were making various pieces for automobiles, involves a lot of chemicals. And these various concoctions, you know, they're hazardous, they produce hazardous waste. And what happened was the State Department of Indiana's environmental management got a anonymous message, and they said there's illegal activity going on at this plant with hazardous waste. So, of course, they're obligated to investigate. They go out to investigate, and what they're told is that hazardous waste is being buried on a nearby walking trail, and that there's a creature that was found in one of the sludge pits. Now, these pits are these massive containers where the remnants of this waste is dumped until it's put in these, you know, certified containers and hauled away to an authorized hazardous waste dump. So purportedly what happened was that this creature was found in one of the pits that someone thought was possibly a mutated animal of some kind, but it looked like a small squid is what they were calling it. They were described as small squid-like things with tentacles and eye-like attachments, and they were living purportedly in the toxic waste in this plant. Now, the environmental folks, the authorities went out and investigated, and there was a whole long back and forth that went on. Curiously, one of these creatures purportedly had been caught and put in a jar. And it was put in the office of, I think, the plant manager, you know, one of the officials, and sitting there on this desk. So mysteriously, that disappeared. And, you know, I keep wondering, you know, whose garage somewhere in Indiana is that thing sitting in? You know, this glass jar with this weird, you know, creature left in it. But what happened, of course, was that, you know, the conspiracy comes in because GMC gets involved and they say, well, no, there's nothing going on. There's nothing improper going on. The sludge pit is quickly cleaned out. Again, before the environmental folks show up. So by the time they get there, you know, everything appears to be okay. You know, oh, there's no evidence of any such thing. Now the officials come down and they make this, the plant clear this pit out again. And at that point, they don't find anything. And, you know, there's all kinds of sort of conspiratorial stuff that goes on. And they interviewed plant workers, and there's different comments from some of them. One of the people they interviewed was an employee who had been with the plant something like 30 years and told a reporter that that there were several of these creatures in this pit, and that one of them had been caught and killed and put in this jar, and it was, you know, set up on the work area. So, you know, these are testimonies coming directly from the people that were working there. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, those are very valuable jobs to have. So this is not, you know, this is not like someone working in a fast food joint who just gets mad and decides to complain and doesn't worry about losing their job or something. I mean, this is, you know, these are valuable careers. You're talking about somebody that's worked for that plant for 30 years. That's kind of interesting. And, you know, the long and short is that everything, all the evidence of these monsters just disappeared. And there's various claims, you know, the one of the officials tried to say, well, no, that was just, there weren't any creatures. It was just a type of bacteria that was in the pit, you know, that's all they were saying. That's all they were seeing. But other people were insistent, no, these were small, you know, squid-like creatures that were living in this toxic chemical sludge. So, very strange tale.
It is as well, and like you say, it's one of those that seems to finish on a cliffhanger, David, because we're all thinking, what happened to this piece of evidence that was purportedly there? It is strange, like you say, because I know when you're writing the investigation up by the environmental employees, as you refer to, Anderson was one of those towns that was essentially built round a GMC, wasn't it? Because it seemed that every single family in the area either had somebody who worked there, or all the adults worked there. It was so dependent on it. So, as you refer to there, these people didn't really have a situation where they could just move, you know, change jobs and whatever, because especially by the end of the 90s, the majority of the plants had been closed down, relocated. So these jobs were a real premium.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's interesting, too, because, I mean, the story got out, and of course, everyone in the town knew about this situation. And in fact, there was a popular tabloid in the U.S. called The Sun. It's kind of along the lines of the National Enquirer and that type of thing. And they did a story about these things, and they called the banner read, "It Came from Plant 9. And, you know, they wrote this whole story, which the tabloid quickly sold out in Anderson. In fact, the newsstand was having all these people calling, you know, saying, "Well, you know, I want a copy of the Sun."
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, you know, being a tabloid style paper, they had to get creative. So they threw some other things in and said, well, you know, this is probably connected to the MIBs, you know, the Men in Black. And, you know, there's no real reason given for why they say this. It just, you know, it sounds more, you know, I guess it's a grander conspiracy to start throwing the Men in Black in there and everything else. So,
yeah.
Fascinating, fascinating freaking story. And then, of course, there was a local lawyer who tried really hard initially to dub Anderson, Indiana, Squid City, USA. And he had these buttons printed up. I've never been able to find one, but apparently he had buttons printed up that said Anderson, Indiana, Squid City, you know, and he hoped to kind of make it a, you know, sort of a I don't know, an iconic thing for the, you know, the town to grab attention or whatever, has some of these do, but just didn't take off for whatever reason.
Well, more shame for him. It seems like a good idea, right, at the time. Yeah, like you say, I wonder if these buttons will certainly be collector's items, David, if there's any out there still, no doubt.
Yeah, right.
yeah, one for every cryptozoological collection, I suspect. I mean, Indiana, you know, as I touched on, isn't one of those states that on face value you look at and you go, oh, yeah. But over the last 3 years, if there's one thing I've learned, is that what I knew 3 years ago about cryptids and creatures pales into insignificance to what I know now. So I've kind of become far more open-minded and learnt so much, primarily, you know, from reading books by yourselves and other such authors, and watching more interesting documentaries about creatures and situations I'd never heard of. But there is one, David, that I've always been aware of, but obviously reading it in your collection, there's a little bit, there's ironically a bit more meat on the bones of this particular tale, which is the Green Clawed Beast, which occurred in August 1955. Now I'd heard this story as kind of a passing, oh, somebody got attacked by something, and some of the versions you've heard it, I've seen it been described as a sea serpent or whatever. However, when you explain the situation and the actual witnesses and the physical evidence that was left, it clearly wasn't a sea serpent.
No, not at all. Not at all. For one thing, it occurred on a river. Of course, you know, Indiana is inland, so there's no oceanfront. And, you know, this is one of those things that the downside, of course, of the internet is that, you know, people, you know, people throw all kinds of things up there, and some of these stories become so distorted over time because someone thinks, oh, this is a great story, and they sort of write their own version of it and throw it up on some website. And, you know, we get all these different variations. And this is a case where, you know, 1955, obviously, you know, not able to go back and really, you know, interview the primary witnesses or anything like that. But in a lot of these cases, it's very difficult when they're older accounts to track anybody down. So this was a case that, you know, it really took a lot of digging into the news sources to find the original reports and to get as close as you can. And that's what I always strive to do. I try to find witnesses if I can, if there are people surviving. And beyond that, I go to original news sources and try to find, you know, the first reports. Because sometimes even with the news, of course, things change slightly. This one, we're fortunate in that, you know, 1955 is not so long ago. There's still the news accounts out there, and there's a couple of people who investigated the case earlier to, you know, put down their thoughts on it. But the account is fairly short. It involves a couple of women who were spending a late summer day on the Ohio River. This happened near Evansville. At one point, there's a woman named Miss Darwin Johnson. Miss Johnson is on the water, you know, on an inner tube. And she's just kind of floating along when something grabs her leg from beneath the water and starts yanking her down. Now, obviously, this terrifies the woman. She's yanked down, and she manages to kick free and come and surface, and then it happens again. Her friend is on the riverbank and sort of, you know, screaming and not sure what to do. Well, Miss Johnson is able to get free of this thing, and she sort of lunges for her friend's inner tube, and she gets out of the water and scrambles onto the riverbank. And once she's out, they called for an ambulance, and a medical treatment came and checked her out. And her claim was that what she felt to be a large, hairy, claw-like hand grabbed her leg and tried to yank her down under the water. It grabbed her just below the knee. Now, the case, you know, on the surface, there's some people were skeptical about it because, of course, the creature from the Black Lagoon was, you know, had been out, and that was sort of the first thing that a lot of people let to, oh, you know, she's imagining things. Some locals said, no, you know, she wasn't grabbed. She probably brushed up against a log that had moss on it. Some people even said it was a turtle.
Yeah.
Of course, we know Indiana has a history with turtles. I'm sure we'll get to that.
Yes.
But, so yeah, some old timers said, oh, that was, you know, it's a giant turtle that she, you know, she hit. But here's where it gets strange, Paul. When Miss Johnson was treated, you know, they found that she had a mark on her leg just below the knee where this thing had grabbed her, and it looked like a palm print. It was green. So this was sort of a stain that was on her leg. And in fact, initially she couldn't get it off. And it stayed visible on her skin for several days.
Mm.
The story is weirder, in my opinion, because the account gets published. And, locals are kind of talking about it. But the Johnsons are paid a visit. And they're paid a visit by a gentleman who claims that he is a colonel with the United States Air Force. And this colonel sits the Johnsons down and he asks them, he asks Miss Johnson about her experience. He asks several details about the encounter. When he finishes, he, quote, advises them to not discuss this case any further. So, again, it's sort of shades of the Men in Black, got this purported Air Force colonel showing up. And, why is he interested in this weird encounter that occurred on the Ohio River? Well, it turns out there had been a number of UFO sightings in the area around the same time. And of course, now we get into territory that makes a lot of cryptozoologists very uncomfortable because, oh my gosh, you're blending,
Yes.
there's a monster, a cryptid account, but then, you're talking UFOs are going on. And once again, this is something that turns up several times in Indiana, curiously enough. But this is a case that it was very intriguing. And, what do you do with it? Why in the world is this Air Force colonel coming interested in a strange encounter that occurs as a woman is floating on the river, swimming around in the water? And sort of the kicker to this is that this encounter occurred on August 21st, 1955.
Hmm.
And there's a fascinating connection because same time, a very bizarre encounter was unfolding on that date in a little place called Kelly Hopkinsville, Kentucky. One of my favorite UFO cases, the Hopkinsville Goblins.
Yep.
Which, of course, we won't go into today, but I'm sure a lot of people will recognize the story.
Mm. Yeah, it is intriguing, like I say, because the UFO sightings actually preceded her incident, I believe, David. So
it did, yeah.
That kind of gives it credence to this mysterious U.S. Air Force gentleman turning up who, as we say, claimed to have been interested in the case and advised them to keep quiet. But it's one of those things that the UFO sightings didn't come to light until this case had happened, I believe. So
that's correct.
You can kind of see, if you want to, as you say, regardless of who we make nervous, mentioning UFOs and cryptids in the same conversation, David, obviously, if you want to take a massive leap, you would say that the two things would be connected in that regard, that maybe whatever was having a paddle beneath the surface was one of the occupants of the strange lights that were seen above the river area.
Well, that's actually kind of what Miss Johnson thought, because she told the one of the papers that she believed that she'd been grabbed by, quote, one of those little green men from a spaceship. So she actually believed that it was some kind of, not necessarily a creature from the Black Lagoon type of thing. She actually believed it was some kind of alien, some UFO occupant that was sneaking around below the surface of the river and I guess, looking to abduct Earth women or something. But it's just, it's such a bizarre case, and it, on the one hand, it sounds kind of, it sort of sounds like a 50s sci-fi movie, unfolding.
Yes.
And at the same time, it's curious enough that we have to look at it and say, well, how do you explain these things? I mean, other people saw this weird handprint on her leg, the case interested someone, whether it was really an Air Force colonel or not, we don't know, but it interested someone in authority who came and wanted to know the details and, you know, encouraged them to not talk about the account. I mean, that's bizarre too.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. There's some tantalizing little morsels hidden amongst that tale, David. It's got a bit of everything from mid-1950s alien paranoia, I think.
Yeah, it sort of does.
I think, as we mentioned there, and we're talking about water-based cryptids, I think the only place we can go next is the wonderful chapter that focuses on the Beast of Busco, the marvellously titled Oscar the Turtle. Now, when I read this, David, I wasn't aware of any of this. I'd heard of the Beast of Busco, but not in the depth that your wonderful writing explains. How this hasn't been made into a film, I do not know, because it's got everything. You've got the old-timey farmer who claims he has this friendly relationship with a giant turtle, who eventually sells his farm after the Second World War to this up-and-coming new farmstead called a gentleman called Gale Harris, I believe. And all of a sudden, we have a giant turtle on the loose in Indiana, and Gale Harris, by God, he's going to prove it.
It's, you know, I agree with you. I've said myself several times, this is a film waiting to happen.
Yep.
If it does, I just hope someone calls me as a consultant, because the story is so incredible. And
yes.
And while it's a cryptid story, it's also a very human story because, as I've said previously, it sort of comes down to a human's response to the unknown, something unusual. And it really kind of boils down to one man's obsession when you look at the overall account. And it does start actually in 1898 when a gentleman named Oscar Folk had a farm, a 7-acre lake on his farm. And he's in a very rural area. He's an old farmer who just happens to mention to town folk that there's a giant turtle living in this lake on his farm. Now, Oscar Folk is not interested in bothering this turtle or anything else. He just lets him be. It's just kind of a point of conversation. And we fast forward. Now, whether this is the same creature or not, you know, who knows? But what we do is we fast forward to 1947, when a gentleman named Gale Harris buys the property. And Harris is a farmer also. And, you know, he's moved on to the property to start farming and make his living. And he proceeds to, you know, fix the property up. He's, starting to farm. By the following summer of 48, the first sort of hint of what's coming occurs. Harris's brother-in-law and another friend of his are on the lake doing some fishing, and they come back to the house, and they're telling this story about there being a giant turtle in this lake. And they're telling Harris that this is a monster, you know, it's probably 500 pounds or more. Now, Harris initially just sort of dismisses this because his brother-in-law is one of those who is kind of prone to tall tales. And, you know, Harris, he's probably one of those moments where he rolled his eyes and said, yeah, okay, well, giant turtle, sure. However, a few months later, Harris and a friend of his are on the roof of the barn doing some repairs when the friend notices something moving around in the water, and he points it out to Harris, and the two men watch this creature, and they see this large head above the surface of the water, and whatever this is swimming around. And initially too, they sort of brush this off and say, huh, okay, well, yeah, you know, must be something in there, something in the water. Mm-hmm. But the next day, they see this creature again, and they decide to go get a look at it. So they go down to the lake, and this time they see it. And Harris says, sure enough, it is a giant turtle. And he estimates that the shell of this creature is probably around 6 feet long. And somewhere around four to five feet wide. So we're talking a pretty substantial creature, you know, a pretty substantial turtle. So Harris, he sort of becomes interested in what initially he calls Mr. Turtle.
Yes, the very original name.
And right. And he keeps spotting this creature, you know, over the course of the next several months and into the next year. And along the way, the local paper gets wind of the story and they report it. Probably a slow news day or something, but they, you know, they post a story about this giant turtle that's, you know, living in this lake on Harris's farm. And the paper makes mention of, you know, someone capturing it, or, you know, it should be captured or whatever. But the long and short is that a couple things happen. Local residents, they dub this animal Oscar. Sort of in tribute to the original owner of the property, Oscar Fulton. But the other thing that happens that is very significant is that Harris himself decides to capture this turtle. And there's some thought that maybe he got interested because there was a rumor of a Cincinnati zoo wanting to purchase the animal and pay, you know, somewhere just under $2,000 for it. A lot of money for that time period.
Yeah.
So in the course of this, of course, Harris, you know, he becomes more and more determined to capture this creature. And that is a real turn in the story, because from that point on, it just gets stranger and stranger. You know, we could sit and talk easily for the whole hour about the account. So, yeah. You know, some of the highlights of this account are that Harris, at one point, he hires different expert turtle catchers from different places, you know, who come in, and they've got, you know, some such contraption. They swear they can catch the turtle. No one's able to do it. Of course, Harris himself has tried with various nets and lines and everything else. At one point, he hires a diver to go down and try to capture the turtle, you know, to try to find it. And that's a whole fiasco that unfolds over, you know, several days, because the diving suit comes, it's faulty. At first, it doesn't have all the pieces. Then it comes and it's faulty. And it's sort of like Murphy's Law takes over when they're trying to catch this turtle. There's one thing after another. And in the course of this, the local news is reporting about the creature, the giant turtle, but it also gets picked up on the news wire, so it's being reported all over the place. Now these stories unfolding about the giant turtle, and we get these different bits of things. You know, this one neighbor who swears that this giant turtle came out of the lake and snatched one of his cows. So we get all these sort of outrageous things that come along in the course of it, and it just becomes really bizarre, because so many people hear about Oscar that they start coming to the farm just in hopes of catching a glimpse of this thing. At one point, there's so much traffic that local law enforcement had to come and sort of coordinate. Because the roads, you know, it's a solid line of traffic leading to this guy's farm. His fields became ruined because people were just driving onto the property and parking everywhere. You know, and Harris, he continues, he spends all of his time and money trying to catch this turtle. It as I said, it gets stranger the further in it goes. At one point, he sort of colludes with the electric company.
Yes.
And they send they agree to help him, you know, shock the water.
Yes.
Thinking that it'll force Oscar to come out. It doesn't work. and the thought is, oh, well, you know, the bottom of the lake is just solid mud. And the thought is, instead of causing him to come out, it just drove him down into the mud where he sort of, you know, buried himself in the mud and just waited it out.
Mm.
So, you know, then Harris decides to pump all the water out. And that's a whole fiasco, too. He's running this contraption off of his tractor, you know, and around the clock has got all these tubes hooked up and he's pumping water out. And, you know, the lines bust at one point, water starts going back in. You know, he gets the lake pretty low at one point, but still is not able to get it completely drained, not able to find Oscar. And, you know, the news has reported this thing so much over and over and over again, and all the various updates and the weird side tales and, you know, people claiming they have Oscar and this and that. And it kind of goes to a point, and then people seem to tire of it, you know, and you just don't hear much for a time until August of 1950, when Gail Harris is back in the news. But this time, it's not so good for him, because the news is that the Harris farm is being put on the auction block. This guy has gone bust trying to catch this turtle. He has spent all of his time, all of his money. He even says at one point he's not able to plant crops, you know, because of various reasons. But I think the reality is he had spent all of his money and, of course, was investing all of his time, too, in trying to catch this thing. So the property sold at auction in 1950. And the new owners who take over the property, they get, of course, all the farmland, the lake, even farm machinery that was left there.
Mm.
And it was funny because in the listing, when it went to auction block, you know, it listed things, you know, like various farm machinery. And one of the items listed was a large turtle net, 200 feet long. And, you know, so the property is sold, and the family who takes it over, of course, they're asked about Oscar, and their response is that Oscar can live in peace in that lake because they had no interest in catching him or even bothering him. So Oscar's left alone, and, you know, sort of end of story, you know, Harris ends up getting a job, ironically, with General Electric.
Yeah.
The same company that had helped him try to shock the turtle out of the water.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's even asked later on about Oscar, and, you know, sort of makes a comment about wanting to try someday again to catch Oscar. But yeah, that's the very short version of The Beast of Busto.
It is incredible, because you're reading all these attempts to catch it and all the various contraptions that they use, David, and all these people coming from around the states who claim, oh yeah, you pay me, I'll guarantee you I'll catch it by this day, and everything they try fails for a variety of reasons. It is hilarious, but like you say, it is rather sad in the end, because clearly Harris was convinced there was something there, because as we've touched on there, David, he drove himself to bankruptcy to try and find it. So it's hard to believe that he would have been mistaken in his belief that what he saw originally, David, that would drive a man to the point and the brink of bankruptcy to try and prove that this creature was there. You would have to think, because clearly business wasn't his strong point, because, you know, if you're getting 2,000 people a day turning up at your farm, right, you should be charging them a parking fee, surely.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd cover the cost of his crops, no doubt. But And it is a rather sad end to it, because this, you know, it's one of those things that we've seen in a variety of different fields, even in the natural kingdom, when we're talking about proven animals that certain people have become so convinced and so determined to either prove something or catch something, David, that everything else in their life just falls away.
That's right. Yeah, and as I said at the beginning, you know, it's very much a story about human obsession in many ways. Yeah. And it's pretty clear that, you know, he did indeed see a physical creature in that lake. Now, of course, it's questionable how big the turtle actually was. You know, it's often people often have a difficult time in estimating the size of such things, especially, you know, you're talking about an object moving around in the water. You know, what was he comparing it to, and so forth. And, you know, at the same time, he became so fixated on it that it's clear that, of course, he says that he saw the turtle multiple times before he really got obsessed with trying to capture it. And I think it's also one of those cases where the more he tried, the more determined he became. Because, you know, like, okay, this didn't work, but I know this will.
Yes.
So it was on to the next thing, and then the next, and then the next. And it did get more and more absurd as it unfolded.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is full of people. I mean, like you say, you mentioned the diver. I mean, he's got the wonderful name of Woodrow Rigsby.
Yes.
and I'm a little bit dubious at how good a diver he actually was, David.
Right.
Because, I mean, it clearly affects people because he ends up trying to hoax that he's caught it, doesn't it? Because he's so humiliated that he's failed to do anything. He ends up I think he buys one from a zoo and pretends it's the right one, and then it all comes out that he's failed, and then he disappears and we never hear from him again.
That's correct, yeah. Well, he was, you know, he was dubbing himself a world famous turtle hunter or something, and then of course, you know, fails in his quest, and it became sort of a personal issue between he and Harris. Yeah. You know, I'm sure there were, you know, various arguments that occurred behind the scenes with that because this guy, you know, failed, and yeah, so he goes into this whole spin where he tries to hoax the situation and claim that he has captured Oscar, and you know, there's other things that happen too. There's a whole case with excuse me, some college students that try to hoax, you know, finding Oscar, and curiously enough, there's a story that pops up in later in 1950 that involves a couple of gentlemen. Again, you know, we're dealing with rural America, you know, in the 1950s. So this gentleman who is a county planning commissioner who is dubbed the Potato King.
Yes.
So the Potato King and a county surveyor are working on draining some swampland to convert it into farmland. And they've created this 30-inch drain to drain water out of the swamp. And at one point it becomes jammed up. And they go to investigate. And what they find is that there's a giant turtle. And they said that the head of this turtle was as big as a human head. And it's the head wouldn't fit into the drain to get out. So the two gentlemen, they try to help this turtle get out. And, you know, I think it's the Potato King, who says, you know, he says he saw this thing. He says, I didn't want to tangle with it. It was as big as a beer barrel.
Yeah.
So he had put his hand on the turtle and said that it was covered with moss, you know, like a moss-covered log, until the head stuck out and this thing looked him in the eye. And I, you know, saw these claws on this thing that were, as he said, as large as a man's finger.
Yeah.
But the, you know, so that turtle kind of goes away and, you know, gets out somehow. But it's evidence of certainly some large specimens existing in the region. And, you know, very possibly, you know, the source of what's going on. And then, you know, when I really dug into this thing, I mean, there's other things that come along that sort of connect to it, because there's an even older story from the late 1800s or something. It predates the Falk sighting, and it's from a gentleman who was working on the railroad. And he said that he had had a conversation with a steward who worked on the dining car of the train, who told this gentleman that his relatives were trying to raise turtles in Indiana. And they had imported these large, what would you call, snapping turtles from the south, and carried them up into Indiana and were trying to see if they would survive, you know, the winter there. Generally more adept at warmer climates in general, but the thought was that, you know, these giant snapping turtles had probably survived to a limited degree up in that region, and that might be what people were spotting.
Because snapping turtles, I mean, they're still one of those creatures, David, that when you come across these cases, because they still turn up in really, really weird areas to this day. And more often than not, I suspect that these are pets that have been bought on the exotic market by some curious person who suddenly realises that they've got quite a ferocious predator in their house. And they do get quite large, because I think they can grow up to about 3 foot, can't they? So they're not...
They can get pretty substantial.
They're pretty... they can be very aggressive when you tangle with them. So people just seem to dump them, don't they, sadly?
Right. It's like, you know, people who buy pet alligators or, you know, exotic snakes and so forth, and then realize this is not going to be a manageable animal. So they drop it off somewhere. But, you know, it's really funny. The whole story with Oscar is a lot of it's about Gail Harris. And of course, the survival of Oscar, I think, is what everyone sort of loves about the tale. You know, he kind of gets away in the end. And there's a lot of different versions of, you know, what happened. Some people think that there were underground channels, you know, that went from the lake to another body of water. Some people believe that Oscar just crawled out of the water one night and you know, headed for a different territory. But it's funny, too, because when you... You know, I dig into this stuff. I try to go from a lot of different directions, you know, the folklore and the actual reports and everything else. And what you find is a curious number of things about turtles that sort of synchronize with all of this. Because, you know, the case I just mentioned that occurred in 1950, the older account about people raising snapping turtles in the area. There's also this whole legend about the Native American people of the region, the Miami tribe, they had a chief named Little Turtle.
Yeah.
Who, you know, purportedly he had a pet turtle at some point. And, you know, there's all these legends that it's this ancient turtle that has always been in the area. So you get these things. And, of course, the legend of Oscar lives on, actually, because the town of Trobusco, they started a celebration way back in 1950 called Turtle Day.
Yeah.
And Turtle Day still goes on. Turtle Day's celebration is every summer. And it's this whole family-friendly, you know, sort of outdoor street fair type of thing, you know. And it celebrates the legend of Oscar to a degree. And I think it's great. It's, you know, one of those... one of those festivals that is built around a cryptid, really, when it comes down.
Yeah, they certainly have seemed to have taken Oscar to their hearts, because I think the fire department have him on the badge as well. They have a turtle.
They do, and in fact, that's, you know, I make mention of that in the book, and I put a photo of one of the patches. You know, the fire department's logo is indeed is a turtle with a fire helmet on and an axe, you know, ready to rush in and save people. So
wonderful. Well, he's an absolute character, and it's certainly as I said at the beginning of this portion, David, that is just ripe for an adaptation, because it is a wonderful study of both humanity and monstrosity going hand in hand.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think the one thing leaving Oscar behind that really surprises me as well about Indiana, not so these days, but at, you know, as for most people, I think, is the amount of Bigfoot and strange encounters. Now, there is a wonderful part of the book which is known as the summer of the gorilla, David, which also it all seems to be happening after the Second World War, because there are a couple of flaps, because obviously we've got the Beast of Busco kicking off around the same point. We've got strange dog-like creatures being seen all over the place, and then everybody in this particular area, which I believe is Thorntown, seems to be seeing what we would describe as a large mountain gorilla on the loose.
Yeah, this is, as you says, 1949. And, you know, the number of accounts that suddenly crop up from this little area is just kind of crazy. And it's usually, this creature is usually described as, first of all, being fairly hideous. People are estimating that it weighs somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 to 300 pounds. And they're saying it's this giant hairy beast with brown hair, large protruding teeth, and sort of visible claws. And you know, there's this whole string of accounts that happened that, once again, regional papers were reporting this thing, and they were sending state conservation officers out trying to capture this thing. There were all these various reports that it was, you know, threatening people who were fishing. In fact, the one of the most significant cases was a couple gentlemen who were fishing along an area at one point, and this thing sort of came out of nowhere and chases them away.
Yes.
And they're saying that, you know, it made a noise like one of Tarzan's companions or something. So we get all these comparisons to it being a gorilla. And you know, these guys have to run into the one of them, in fact, waded into the creek to get away from this thing, and the other one took off in the other direction and ran into the woods. So people feel very threatened by this thing, and you know, the state officials, they can't really figure out what's going on. And as is often the case, of course, they never capture this thing. There's various theories that surface. You know, some people are claiming, oh no, it's just a, you know, somebody pulling a prank, and they've got a gorilla suit. There's a bizarre story that surfaces when police officers catch this woman who it turns out that you know, they find this woman, and she asked them if they're, and she says, do you think I've scared them enough? And they're kind of puzzled by this. This is a really rough looking woman. They believe she was homeless at the time, and it turned out she was actually someone who had been institutionalized. And they, you know, they end up sending her back to the institution. But you know, there's people that are saying there's no way it was this woman. Of course, you know, as is often the case, authorities are looking for anything to sort of shut these accounts down and say, no, it's not, you know, we've solved it. It's something normal, and we understand it. So, you know, don't give us any more stories about gorillas running around town or anything. But of course, the accounts continued until suddenly they were just done.
Yeah, because I think this lady that they stumble across in the woods, they kind of think, yeah, right, she's been pulling everybody's leg, even though, as you've referred to, David, she doesn't seem to match what some people have seen quite closely.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I believe that everything dies down, and then there's a couple driving on the wonderfully named Crooked Bridge. Which is a rather remarkable encounter, because you've got a man and a wife driving. I think he's called John Maines or John Manes. I'm not sure how you would pronounce his name. But they claim that this creature comes running out from under the bridge and hits them so hard it knocks the car off the road.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, this couple, they, of course, they reported this to the sheriff. And they sort of described it as in the same fashion that other people had been describing this beast. But they did say that it had what they called extra long tusks.
Yeah.
Protruding from its mouth on each side. And this is a curious encounter, just because it sort of reinvigorates the whole, you know, safari to capture this thing. You know, all these people come running out with shotguns, and they're, you know, they're beating the bushes and trying to find this beast. And after they have their encounter on the crooked bridge, there are a few other people who report this creature around the bridge also.
Mm.
And there's physical evidence found too, because at one point there's tracks that are found that measure somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 inches.
Mm.
But then the sheriff kind of brushes those off and says, no, those are hoaxed tracks. We don't really know, of course. You know, again, this is an older case, so we can't go back and look at the physical evidence from it. But yeah, there's a lot of people who spot this thing. There's a guy driving a bread truck at one point who claims he sees the thing, you know, running along on the highway or near the highway that he's traveling down. And the sheriff and the deputy, you know, they're running around trying to spot this thing, and there's a whole search that goes on around the crooked bridge. They find some other notable things. There's a pile of garbage that's in the woods around the bridge, and they find evidence that something has been basically eating the debris. That's the food debris that's there, and there's pieces of apples and banana peels and things like that, and it's clear that something has been using that as a spot to, you know, get some free lunch. And you know, they even you know, it's crazy because it's 1949, but at one point they even they go up in a plane and try to spot this thing from the air, hoping to, you know, get a bead on exactly what it is and run it down. But ultimately the sightings just kind of end, and the creature, whatever it is, has apparently moved off to greener pastures, because it's never spotted around there again.
Yeah, and it is surprising as well, David, because we've often come across this many a times, that no one says, oh yeah, it's escape from a circus, which used to be quite a lot of excuses for anything that's weird that people spot. You know, the amount of circus trains that must have crashed across America, according to the authorities, must be in the hundreds. But
I know, yeah, thousands probably. And it's funny, because in Indiana in particular, in fact, I poke a bit of fun about that in the book, because there are so many cases in Indiana where that's the go-to answer, you know, by be it authorities or newspapers or whatever. So, oh yeah, well, it's, you know, there was a circus train crashed here, you know, at whatever point. And yeah, you would think that, you know, if you really believed all these accounts, I mean, the circuses should have had no animals for years, because they've all gotten loose and they're running around rural America.
Yeah. To be honest, David, reading that, the last thing I would ever want to do if I worked for a circus would catch a train. You know, you'd be like, what are you doing? Have you not heard about what happened in Indiana?
Right.
You know? So, yeah, it always makes me chuckle that you know, it is. And you can say that across so many cases and so many states, between sort of over like a 50-year period, that it's escape from a circus. Really?
Yeah.
Right, okay, no problems. I think there is another fabulous section that looks into the Bigfoot cases, and there's one primarily that I found really interesting, which is the ones that occur at the beginning of the 1970s, David, on a gentleman called DK on his farm. And this has all the prime ingredients that we see too often, sadly, that here we have an experienced outdoorsman who's worked on his farm for decades, who knows the area, knows the locality, and he has a very unusual series of encounters with something he can't explain. And he's basically ridiculed to the point that he just won't talk about it anymore.
Right. Yeah, this is, you know, this is a very fascinating period, because even though, of course, we have all these various monster accounts that crop up over the years in Indiana, there's something very intriguing for me about what I refer to as a decade of monsters.
Mm.
And there's sort of a prelude to it in 1969 in the small town of Rising Sun, when there's an encounter that occurs, some sightings of a very strange creature, but it really kicks off in the 1970s. And what we get are all of these creatures who end up with local nicknames, you know, so to speak, like the Mill Race Monster and so forth.
Yeah.
But the summer of 71, the case you're referring to, this is a gentleman named, who's referred to as DK, and he has a property in Tipton County. He hears his dog out fighting with something one day, and he goes outside, and his dog, Zipper, is sort of biting at, you know, snapping and growling at this large hairy creature. And the whole encounter is just very bizarre. For one thing, DK says this thing was somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 feet tall.
Yeah.
And that it had very stringy, dirty hair. He said it was sort of ape-like, but that its head wasn't completely human or ape. And he told later, he said that the thing's head looked like it was wearing a furry helmet.
Yes. A wonderful description.
It is. And it's kind of bizarre. And, you know, I thought about that. And then, you know, if you think about, of course, what a lot of people refer to as a sagittal crest, you know, that point. Well, in some cases, you know, that kind of would look like a helmet to some people, or a hat. You know, I've heard native lore refer to these things as wearing like a hat or a pointed hat. So that might be what he was spotting in this particular case. But he said that the odor that came from this thing was just horrible, that it was a sickening smell that he described something like decaying meat and vegetables. And, you know, he watched this very bizarre encounter unfold between this creature and his dog. And what he said was that neither one of them were hurting the other, and that this creature, it would sort of swing its arms in slow motion at the dog.
Yeah.
As the dog was sort of, you know, leaping in and out and you know, snapping and growling. So this creature is sort of swaying its arms in, again, what he described as being slow motion, and it was issuing a growl as it did so. But the dog, equally, is, of course, lunging in as if it's trying to bite, but it never connects with this creature. And, you know, of course, he perceived it as a fight ensuing between the two, and obviously, you know, neither of us were there. But when you look at it in some terms, you can kind of listen to that, and it's almost like they were sort of playing, or the creature was playing with the dog, is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
And it's such a bizarre encounter. You can just imagine this gentleman seeing this strange sight. And of course, he runs inside and retrieves his shotgun and comes back out and takes a shot off at the thing, and the creature, you know, ends up escaping into the woods. But the authorities come out, and, you know, they investigate the case, and as you say, he ends up being sort of harassed about this thing, and there are other sightings. His mother is on the property, and she's seen the thing, and other people who live on the farm have also seen the creature. But it's a very bizarre set of encounters, and like a lot of the state's creatures, you know, it's around for a period of time, and then it just sort of goes away, and that's seemingly the end of it until something similar pops up elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, that initial encounter, as you say, David, my take from how he described it was that they were playing, because we're talking about two wild animals, and there are hundreds of alleged fatal interactions, because there are loads of cases of Bigfoot being seen and sighted, and dogs go missing or dogs end up being fatally injured, David.
That's right.
This is one of the few encounters I've certainly read. You may certainly know more about that, David, where we seem to have this kind of playful interaction, because, you know, if a dog wanted to go for something, it would go for it. And likewise, if we're talking about a 9-foot-tall hominid, I don't think it would be really too frightened of a dog.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you would think, you know, something that large, you know, certainly its reach and its speed, you know, it's going to be able to, if it was really determined, it's going to be able to put that dog out of commission fairly easily. But that just doesn't occur in this case. So it is, it's such a strange interaction, and it's fascinating, you know, when you take the account from sort of a different perspective, because as I said, DK more or less portrays it as, oh, these things were fighting, you know, and I mean, he even states that he heard his dog, he believed his dog was fighting with something, so he went out to find out what the noise was about. And, you know, probably the animal was making those types of alert sounds or whatever, but again, you know, when we sort of step back and listen to the details of the interaction, it does sound like this creature was playing with the dog. Of course, until DK comes along with a shotgun and ends playtime.
Yeah, enough's enough.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And there does seem to be a whole spate of them, as you touch on. There's a couple of them, you know, that... the Millrace Monster, and I mean, I love some of these names that have came, because there seems to have been a real spate of these across the states in the 70s, and I'm sure somebody would say, oh well, that's because everybody'd seen the Patterson-Gimlin film or Boggy Creek, so everybody was seeing monsters everywhere, David. But there does seem to be something peculiar that these little towns just have these big flaps for a few months, and then it just vanishes again.
They do, and you know, a lot of times there are multiple witnesses. You know, there's strange aspects. We were talking earlier about, you know, that sort of mixture of phenomena, and we get that again in 73 with what's called the Rochdale Monster. And this is a case that Jerome Clark investigated. Lauren Coleman has looked into it. It's a whole series of encounters that occurred, you know, again, small rural communities. People were seeing this strange creature, but once more, UFO sightings also in the area around the same time, and very bizarre things. You know, people were describing these sort of orbs of light that showed up over this field, and, you know, sort of morphed and coalesced into some kind of a creature. Very, very strange things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I don't want to spoil too many of these wonderful tales, David. I think the last thing I want to touch on before I let you go to your investigation, sir, is the marvellous little section you've got on one of the more frighteningly named creatures that you cover, which is the Ghoul Snake of Oxford.
Yeah.
Now, this is a very strange case, because this seems to terrify a whole community so much, they change the way they bury people.
Very bizarre. And, you know, it appropriately, we kind of come full circle back to my good friend Chad Lewis. And,
yes.
his another good friend, Kevin Nelson.
Yeah.
Because these fellows looked into this case. This is something that is fairly brief, and it goes back again to the mid-1800s, late 1800s, small town of Oxford. And in this area in the 1800s, there's a sudden concern amongst locals about what they say is a giant snake living in the town cemetery and feasting on the deceased. So there's a whole news report that was published in one of the local papers claiming that this thing was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 feet in length, that it was as large as a good-sized stovepipe, to use lingo of the day.
Yes.
And they're saying that this thing was living underground in the cemetery, and the town is suddenly concerned about the remains of it. It's, you know, dearly departed.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could sort of look at this account and say, okay, this is one of those really weird, curious accounts. You know, it was something that was sort of a one-off, because there's no record of anyone having actually caught it or anything else.
But it gets bizarre because we fast forward to 2018, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my friends Chad and Kevin made a trip to Oxford, and they stopped by the town cemetery to check out the legend of the ghoul snake. And what do they find? But a very curious thing. They find an enormous mausoleum in the cemetery. And this is a small rural town.
Yeah.
So it's unusual to find, you know, something like this. And it seems that there's a possibility that people were so worried about this snake at some point in history that they started burying their dead in snake-proof vaults.
Yes.
And oddly enough, Kevin and Chad discovered these very large holes at various points in the cemetery that were, they looked like snake holes going in and out of the ground. So, you know, this is one of those things that we have to consider. Is this, you know, is there something still lurking in that cemetery? Is there something, is it just a weird coincidence? Or is there something a bit more to the traditional lore of this little town?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is a very creepy tale. And like I said, clearly the people were so affected that they were convinced that this was going on, David.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's one of the things I love about digging into this kind of stuff, because you find oftentimes evidence in different ways to support that the story at least was believed to be true to a certain degree by some locals. And in this case, I think that's what we find. You know, how much there was behind it, how much truth there was behind it, is difficult to say. But hey, you know, there's always the possibility that it was an escaped circus snake that got loose in
Oxford. Of course.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Of course it was. Absolutely, yeah. Why didn't I think of that, David? Oh, brilliant. Well, listen, Monsters at the Crossroads, which is the title of the Indiana book, is absolutely fabulous, and we've touched on some of the exciting cases, but the book is chock full of other things we've not talked about, from other Bigfoot sightings to strange snakes and people even claiming to see lions and panthers hanging out together. It's just wonderful, the collections that you bring forward, David. So
and werewolves.
Werewolves as well, which we've not even touched on, and I'm sure I will get an email from somebody complaining that I've not mentioned werewolves, as I get told off for not mentioning werewolves enough, David. That's something I may have to deal with in the future, I suspect. But like I say, Monsters at the Crossroads is another fabulous volume in these series, and I'm always excited, like I say, because primarily there are some stories, as I said at the beginning, that I'm aware of, but, you know, 90% of the stuff that you collect and investigate, David, I've never heard of. So it's always wonderful to see what you've got in store. So with that in mind, what's next? Which state are you going to regale us with in your next chapter of these wonderful books?
Well, the next one that was just recently announced is Monsters of the Tar Heel State, which is North Carolina. So Cryptids and Legends of North Carolina is up next. The cover has been revealed, another masterpiece by Sam Sharon.
Yep.
And the creature on the front is the Beast of Bladenboro, which is a very frightening thing that was killing all kinds of animals in rural North Carolina.
Yeah.
And, of course, lots of other fascinating stuff to share in that book. Won't talk about it too much, obviously, because the book's not out yet, but I expect it sometime around the new year. I know I've had lots of messages after the cover was revealed, hoping it would be out, you know, for Christmas, but it maybe might be right before Christmas, but we'll see what happens. It's wrapped up and it's just in the final stages of production, but of course there's lots of other things going on too. So that's the next one that is up in the Cryptid State series.
Fabulous. And I remissly didn't mention the fact that there was a volume of Woodknocks released as well this year, David. Volume 4 came out at the beginning of the year as well.
So yes, that's right.
Is that series continuing? Because they are fabulous. as someone that has all four of the volumes so far, what I love about them is that there is something for everybody, regardless of your theories or beliefs in what Bigfoot is. So, and I remember the very first time we spoke, David, I said... I was very impressed with the fact that because the Bigfoot Field is known for its camps, shall we say, I was very impressed with the fact that you'd managed to get so many people to come together. So is that something that's ongoing?
That's the biggest challenge, probably. you know, coordinating various creative personalities and so forth. But you know, I'll be honest. I mean, you know, when number 3 came out, I said, no, probably not anymore. And then, of course, there was interest, and a few people said, oh, I want to do something. And so each time, you know, it's that's the old adage, never say never. It does look like number 5 will be coming out next year. I already have some interesting things lined up for the next volume, so you can look forward to that next year.
Good. Something else for me to spend my hopeful Amazon Christmas gift vouchers on, David. Well, as always, David, it's a real pleasure to speak to you. And as I said before we started the real interview, I can't believe it's a year since you've been on, because it was last Christmas that you were on. And obviously with a new book in the near future, I will guarantee you it won't be 12 months till I speak to you again. Hopefully it'll be no less than a couple.
Well, sounds good, Paul. And of course, people can find me at eerielights.com. That is eerielights.com. And all the books, of course, are on Amazon.
Fabulous. Well, David, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, as always, for your continued availability and pleasant conversation. And long may it continue. Thank you for your time, as always.
Happy holidays, Paul. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
And a Merry Christmas to you and yours, sir.